From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today we'll hear a special BBC World Service program, The Lipinski, which tells the dramatic story of MSO concertmaster Frank Almond and the theft and recovery of the Lipinski Stradivarius violin he plays.
I was a translator at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials in 46, 47, and a friend there said, there's a violinist, you should maybe get to know her.
Traveling with a violin of that ilk is like traveling with a small child.
How else do you come to terms with what Stradivari achieved? It's like Andy Murray winning Wimbledon with a racket from the time of Charles II.
I suppose I am a violin doctor. You know, I'm ninth generation of the family that's done this. 1699, the first one actually started. I'm going to be the last.
The BBC World Service production of The Lipinski is next on Lake Effect. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Happy New Year. Today we're taking a bit of a departure from our normal show, but Milwaukee does remain the focus, as you'll soon hear. You may remember that last year, Milwaukee made international headlines when the MSO's concertmaster Frank Almond was tasered in a parking lot after a performance, and the instrument that he plays, the Lipinski Stradivarius violin, was stolen from him. Late last fall, the BBC contacted the Lake Effect staff to let us know that a documentary about that incident and about the violin itself was being produced, and they asked for our help. Well, this is that documentary. Peter Curran is the producer and presenter of the Lipinski, and we'll let him take the story from here.
But I do know what made Milwaukee famous. Listen.
I'm Peter Curran, and now on the BBC World Service, the extraordinary tale of the Lipinski Stradivarius. This is the story of a small musical instrument that over the past 300 years has brought out the best and the worst of men and women, brought transcendent musical joy to audiences and players, paranoia, violence and prison time to some of those who have held it in their hands. The story will pull us through war-torn Germany, Italy, pre-revolutionary Cuba and mid-Sussex, then on to the dimly lit car park of a concert hall in the American Midwest.
This isn't a violin. This is a multi-million dollar musical instrument. This is the crime of the century.
I just kind of thought to myself, whoever was carrying that violin around just was really asking for it.
I was a translator at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials in 46, 47, and a friend there said, there's a violinist, you should maybe get to know her.
Traveling with a violin of that ilk is like traveling with a small child.
How else do you come to terms with what Stradivari achieved? It's like Andy Murray winning Wimbledon with a racket from the time of Charles II.
I suppose I am a violin doctor. You know, I'm ninth generation of the family that's done this. 1699, the first one actually started. I'm going to be the last.
There was a taser barb sticking out of my jacket and one stuck in my wrist right there. I was bleeding on my shoes and the whole thing was just like, what? You know, those guys took your violin and shot you. Just couldn't believe it.
The Lipinski is the name given to a famous Stradivarius violin, and today it's reported to be worth $6 million in the US market. When Antonio Stradivari made this violin, he was at the height of his golden period, and he was an early example of people continuing to work further and further into old age. Biographer Toby Faber.
He lived a long life. He was 92 or 93 when he died. He had two marriages, which between them had 11 children. The last of them born when he was well into his 60s. What really interests me about Antonio Stradivari is actually when we talk about his golden period, really the violins that date from that period, he's already in his 50s, 60s and 70s when he's making those violins. So almost the first part of his life, what for most people would be their entire working life, he's just preparing really for this period. And that's when he made the violins that are still the most valuable and sought after in the world. 1715, which is when the Lipinski was made. He is by then probably about 71. By about the 1720s, the golden period, people would say, is coming to an end. His violins are still, in terms of the tone they produce, still as magnificent as the ones that went before, and some of his absolute great violins, famous violins, date from that period. But you can start to see some signs of age in the workmanship. So the hand that's carving the sand holes is a little bit shaky, that sort of thing. What's interesting is that he carried on making violins when he wasn't selling them. And I think that shows some sort of obsession, actually.
It's hard to imagine what it was like being the brilliant, obsessive, older man who made the Lipinski 300 years ago. But we can perhaps get an echo of that world. I'm in Sussex and outside the discreet front door of Peter Voigt, whose ancestors were making instruments at the same time as Antonio Stradivari. And he is the latest in an unbroken family line of violin craftsmen that stretches back to his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Hi, Peter, how are you doing?
All right, you?
Yeah, good. Good to see you.
Well prepared.
I'm travelling light.
Or is it already running?
I just switch it on and it just runs.
I'm dealing with 16th century technology and it's lovely. And I still think electricity is the spawn of the devil, you see, so...
But
I'm being dragged slightly screamily into some of this modern kit, but
your business is probably a mixture of precision technique, but Beagle,
yeah,
as
half,
well.
I mean, half a thou I'm working to, because I put the micrometer on what I cut off the feet of the bridge when fitting it. It's half a thou.
That's half a thousandth of an inch.
Yes, and that's by hand with a handheld knife, you know. But then, of course, I've been in business for 53 years, because a lot of it is repairing instruments that players have damaged.
People do say that violins made by Stradivari, the palette of sound that they can use with that particular instrument gives them confidence and means they can go to places they don't have to work the instrument as hard. Would you buy any of that?
Well, tonally, I think there's a lot of dispute over that, because perhaps I shouldn't run down Mr. Stradivari. But I'm a great believer that this is an antiques trade that's complicated by players, because what what you can't do is buy tone.
Do you think then there's a little bit of emperor's old clothes about Stradivari violins?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you're a big name player and they ask you as you're going on stage, what have you got? Is he really going to admit having a Fred Bloggs of Bermondsey? You know, it's
I haven't come across Bloggs. Was he good?
No, he was crap. However, I do know I'm ninth generation of the family that's done this, and it goes back to Germany. Southern Germany, there's an area called Voigtland, Folkland. 1699, the first one actually started. Both grandfathers came over here to Liverpool in about 1900. I'm going to be the last. I hope I haven't done anything about continuing this.
Opened up his case and he said, I'll start this show, and fire flew from his fingertips as he rolled up his bow.
In the 1970s, the Charlie Daniels Band told of a brilliant violin player being visited by the devil. Not the first time Satan had let a musician know that he had the best tunes. Giuseppe Tartini, the great Italian composer and violinist, who was the first owner of the Stradivarius, was visited by Satan in a dream. There are lots of rather frightening paintings of this scene as the devil played a fiendishly, difficult but beautiful piece of music to Tartini. And when the composer awoke with a start, he furiously began composing what became known as his best work, the Devil's Trill Sonata. It was one of Tartini's former pupils, the great Signor Salvini, who passed the violin on to its next owner, the person who would give this Strad the name we know it by today. Karol Lipinski was a brilliant young Polish violinist, only too delighted to have a private audition with Salvini.
Signor Salvini says, "Give me your violin."
Toby Faber.
He hands over his violin and Salvini smashes the violin on the table beside him into a million fragments, I think is what Lipinski says. And then turns round, picks up a violin and says, "Now, try this violin." And the violin he is talking about is the violin we now call the Lipinski. Salvini tells him that this is a Stradivarius violin from 1715, which was passed on to him by Tartini. So that is what gives us the provenance for this violin that takes it back from Lipinski through Salvini back to Tartini.
Programming on WUWM.
A pretty and sunny morning, but a little
welcome
on the
back
chilly
to Lake
side.
Effect. You are listening to us on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Peter Curran joins me this morning to talk about why he's doing a piece on the Lipinski violin. He is here from London. And Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. It's lovely to touch base with the hub of the arts establishment in Milwaukee.
The Lipinski currently resides here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is where Hollywood legend Spencer Tracy grew up. While he was winning Oscars in Hollywood, the Lipinski Strad was on its way to Cuba and into the wealthy hands of Dr. Jose Cañas. He would invite some of the world's best musicians and composers, such as Yasha Heifetz and George Gershwin, back to his house after their concerts in Havana. For a hoedown and a go on the Lipinski. The Cuban violinist Angel Reyes used it all around the world. Now, one historian, Professor Jorge Dominguez, says that the story of Cuba at this time is one of social and economic warfare as America was in retreat from empire building. But frankly, America was not in retreat from having a good time in Cuba, as evoked in Gershwin's wordless lexicon of luxury, Cuban Overture. By the early 60s, the sumptuous pre-revolutionary experience was well and truly over in Cuba. Fidel Castro was in power and the Cañas family needed to start a new life elsewhere, possibly in a great hurry. This meant selling the Lipinski at a bargain price. Its new owners were the Estonian violinist Evie Levak and her husband Richard Anschus. They'd met in extraordinary circumstances.
I was a translator at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials in 46, 47, and a friend there said, there's a violinist in Fürth, you should maybe get to know her. Very well, I went to Fürth, which is right next to Nuremberg, and I met her and her mother there. And Evie was traveling around playing for the army and whatnot and so forth and different concerts and so on.
Evie Levak had seen her father, an Estonian patriot, shot by the Gestapo. When the war ended, she played a concert for refugees in the heavily bombed Munich Concert Hall. It was freezing, and the audience, the orchestra, and the conductor wore their heavy winter coats. Miss Levak, on the other hand, strode on stage in a bare-shouldered evening gown.
She made a beautiful appearance on the stage, very sober, and very elegant, and she was a treat for the eyes and for the ears, of course. As fragile as she seemed to be as a human being, I mean, when you just saw her, that she had tremendous power. She played like a man, and of course, in every respect, it was just the highest artistic caliber you can imagine.
After a long playing career, Evie Levak died in New York, and her husband, Richard, moved here to Milwaukee to be near his relatives, with the treasured Lipinski under his arm. All went quiet for years. I am on my way now to meet Frank Almond, who is concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra.
Hi, how are you doing?
Follow me.
Yes, the maestro awaits.
I got an email one morning about this instrument that had kind of surfaced. And at first we were both sort of like, you know, this is one of those, I found a Strad in my attic. I'm sure it's a Strad, it's got a Strad label. And, you know, that's where my mind goes first, but it's not a Strad. There was this weird Milwaukee connection. And then it turned out that the instrument had been stored in a vault, like about 200 yards from the concert hall that I play in every week. and had been sitting there for like 10 months.
My name is Stefan Hirsch. My principal way of making a living is trading in rare violins, and I have a business in Chicago called Darnton and Hirsch. Expectation was high, and a little lingering worry, because when there is all that expectation and it's not met, then you have the problem of mopping up.
What are you looking for, and what are the things that confirm your belief?
When you're in the room with a Stradivari and you pull it, you know, into the light, there's this kind of warm glow. Actually, all those classic Cremonese instruments have a version of that. And so the first thing I noticed was that it had just gorgeous ruby red varnish all over it, which is consistent with one type of Stradivari from that period. And then I immediately began to take in the form, and Stradivari has a particular boldness and sharp kind of workmanship in that period. They're really unmistakable, and I could see right away that the violin had all of those features and was like visiting another relative in a family I know well.
I'm Elaine Schmidt. I am the classical music and dance writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I also write books on music.
Can I give you my probably entirely incorrect crackpot theory about the Lipinski and Milwaukee? And you, as a cultural commentator of note here, might be able to either say how stupid and silly I am being, or think, wow, Peter, that's a ringing endorsement of,
I can't
of
wait.
The thing. Yeah, exactly. Here it comes. Milwaukee, known as a city of brewing, traditionally a city of working people that would not darken the doors of the classical music world or concert halls. And in a way, the Lipinski, in the hands of Frank Almond, an accessible way into that world. Beautiful classical music, not for an elite, but for everyone.
Milwaukee has an odd and very long arts history. And one of the things Milwaukee has had for generations is singers. This was a very German city. And there was a time when even the major corporations had choruses. And I believe Alan Bradley might have been the last of the big choruses. I mean, big choruses. We're not talking quartets. We're talking 100 or more people. And huge church choirs. There's still a German Menner Chor. There are just an extraordinary number of singers in this town. And that, I think, bleeds into the arts and into music nicely. They are maybe not as adventurous as a New York or Chicago audience, although there's a thriving, small but thriving, new music ensemble and devoted followers. It's and a really thriving early music presenter here, presenting international early music ensembles. It's not what you expect.
Frank Almond is a distinguished violinist who has attracted new audiences and world-class players to guest with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and his own chamber music concerts have proved very popular. Before we got to talk about how he got his hands on the Lipinski Stradivarius violin, he told me about his childhood on the beaches of California. Not a typical place for a young classical violinist.
Well, you know, the cliche of getting beat up with your violin case certainly has a bit of truth.
Really?
But at the same time, I mean, I was trying to lead a fairly normal life as a teenager in Southern California. And I'm glad I did, because then later on when I sort of came to it, it was of my own volition rather than what happens a lot with younger kids who are really, really gifted. They just kind of flame out, or their parents just crush them.
Your parents were both musicians. Were they thrilled or very worried that their son wanted to follow the same path?
They had a lot of unhappy musician friends. So my younger brother and I are both musicians. My younger brother's a drummer and quite gifted and practiced a lot at one end of the house. And I was on the other end of the house doing my thing. So there was quite a bit of noise around. Also, my mom's a piano teacher, so she was sort of in the middle of the house trying to teach these kids. So anybody that lived nearby us, I will now apologize for the noise in our house.
I was going to the Juilliard School for you.
Well, I think the difference between going to school in a place like New York and going to a school in a place like Philadelphia or Boston is just the amount of cultural activity going on. They're all very different cities. And if you're a student in New York City, especially at an arts institution, any night of the week, there were 10 different things to choose from. If you're smart and you can kind of immerse yourself in it at that age and just be sort of overwhelmed by what's going on, of course it seeps into everything you're doing, especially if you have a kind of natural curiosity. So for me, it was like a playpen. I mean, I loved it there. It's a weird place because you're in Lincoln Center and you're a student, but at the same time, the performance level is not necessarily going to, you're playing for the same audiences that are across the street listening to the New York Philharmonic, you know, or anybody else that's in that area. So the lines between being a student and being professional, I think, get a little blurred, and I learned that very early on. It wasn't always the easiest place to be, but I enjoyed a lot of things about it.
What about that whole thing about being on stage? Obviously, there must be a bit of a show-off as well as the virtuoso instrumentalist inside you. What's going through your head? Why are you laughing?
Well, because, yeah, I think that's true. I just don't necessarily see myself as a show-off, and probably am not known for that unless you talk to a couple of people. I don't know. That's just not the word that would come to mind, I suppose.
It's not a job for a modest person.
This is what, yeah. I mean, you develop a voice that and a kind of confidence, I think, where you are not so much concerned with the audience and you're more concerned about what you're trying to get across and what you have to say and why people should pay attention to it. That becomes a driving force. For some people, that means they're going to be flamboyant and show off virtuosity and really are show-offs, and it's more about them. But I think to be a really great musician, in any kind of music, by the way, it's not just about the performer. You're trying, ultimately, you're sort of communicating in a abstract way, of course, especially with classical music. It can be very, very abstract.
Do you think you need to be knocked out of shape a little bit by life to discover the true richness of music sometimes?
I don't know. I've heard some extraordinarily gifted young artists who seem to have some kind of like cosmic maturity, or else they're really faking it well. But I've also seen a lot of older musicians that sound the same or close to the same 20 years after the first time I heard them, and they just are kind of doing the same thing. You know, I think, like most artists, you hope to evolve in some level and are constantly reexamining what you're doing and pushing yourself and trying to do different things. I am, anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really just working as a soloist either. So I had opportunities to do that, maybe that a really famous soloist early on might not. For example, you know, if you suddenly have 300 concerts a year and you're 17 years old, you're basically a soloist wrapped up in this kind of, you know, kind of stuck in this box.
The Lipinski violin brings great creative benefits to a player, but it also means there's nowhere to hide.
I often will use the analogy, like, you know, you're used to painting with 5 or 6 different colors, and then somebody gives you a palette with, like, you know, 50 colors. Or if somebody gives you a Strad, it's more like a million colors. And then it's kind of up to you with what you do with it. It's not about, oh, I don't have a great violin, so I can't sound good anymore. You know, it takes away a lot of any excuses, really.
And I guess that there's no going back once you've, you know, played on a fantastic instrument like a Strad. There's just a whole world of pain and frustration if you're not playing on anything that has that gigantic palette of color.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think you get used to it. You know, I was not in a position to buy an instrument like that.
The $1 million instrument he is playing on is not Frank Allman's own. It's on loan to him, a fact he never forgets.
The parameters of someone loaning you an instrument can vary widely. So I was always cognizant of the fact that I have a limited amount of time to play on it, and I'm going to make the most out of it. That's how I saw it. And if somebody needs it back, which they will eventually, somebody else gets that opportunity, and I'm all for that.
And we'll continue the story of the Lipinski very shortly.
The BBC World Service.
We'll take a short break now. In a moment, we'll return with the second part of the BBC World Service radio documentary, The Lipinski, so stay tuned. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Let's get back to the second part of the BBC World Service radio documentary, The Lipinski.
This is Peter Curran with you on the BBC World Service, telling the story of one of the world's best-known instruments, the Lipinski Stradivarius Violin. It's been through the hands of some extraordinary musicians. Giuseppe Tartini, the great 18th-century Italian violinist, who was reportedly visited by the devil in a dream, playing a seductive melody on the instrument. When Tartini awoke, he tried to compose a piece based on that melody, and it became known as his Devil's Trill Sonata. One of Tartini's pupils, Signor Salvini, inherited the violin, and when he was visited by the young Polish violinist Karol Lipinski, he had a nice surprise for him. But first, he took Lipinski's own violin and smashed it to pieces before giving him the treasured Stradivarius that had belonged to Tartini. Lipinski was an amazing player. He and his father had been forced to play for wealthy Russians occupying what today is known as the Ukraine. Lipinski became one of the best violinists in Europe, helped by the extraordinary volume and expressiveness of the violin that we today call the Lipinski. He became friends with the composer Robert Schumann, who dedicated his Carnival to Lipinski. The 20th century saw the instrument travel to Cuba during the 1940s with Dr. Jose Cañas. Cuba was a playground for rich foreign visitors at this time. But by the early 60s, the revolution had happened and the Cañas family felt it would be a good idea to start a new life elsewhere, quickly. The Lipinski was sold to a wealthy New Yorker who gave it to one of her relatives, the Estonian violinist Evie Levak, who enjoyed a long career after being caught up dramatically in World War II. When she passed away, her husband Richard Anschutz brought the violin to Milwaukee to be near his own family in old age. And it was that family who eventually contacted Frank Almond of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, offering to loan him the violin so it could once again thrill audiences rather than just sit in a bank vault like a $6 million antique. Though for the person carrying the violin, that means a lot of responsibility. Classical music critic Elaine Schmidt.
Traveling with a violin of that ilk is like traveling with a small child. Always aware of where it is. Is it too close to a draft? Can you feel it or see it? You know, is your foot touching the case? I know it's cantankerous, and some days it is different than other days. But, oh my, it's worth dealing with. It's a beautiful, beautiful sound. You can do just amazing little whispers that are incredibly clear.
That arresting sound is captured on the album A Violin's Life, which Frank Almond financed by crowdfunding, and which features the Lipinski and music associated with the violin over the past 300 years. The album received critical acclaim, but after a sellout concert in January 2014, the Lipinski reached a much wider audience for all the wrong reasons.
One of the world's most respected violinists attacked and robbed of his $6 million instrument right here in Milwaukee.
Valuable heist in Milwaukee's history, the armed robbery of a violin.
Monday night, Almond finished a concert here at Wisconsin Lutheran College and was walking to his car with the violin, which was...
Almond was tased with a stun gun by thieves who made off with a 1715 Stradivarius.
It really was kind of an amazing concert.
Frank Almond.
With some fantastic musicians and a great program, and we were all sort of very happy about that. And that within 12 hours, that had been completely overshadowed by everything else.
Going backstage by torchlight?
Kind of. Oh, here we go. So
we're just going to head out to the rear of the concert hall. So you would have left the stage here, Frank, in triumph?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's not the kind of piece where you sort of raise your arms above your head at the end, you know. But we were happy about it. And so we, after that, we came in here. The dressing rooms are around there. And we just got our stuff. And I think Todd and Joe went out through this door a little bit ahead of me. So... And I was parked right there. And right here was this van backed in. But it was running. And I was starting to put my violin here. And out of my peripheral vision, there was somebody walking around the front of the van. I remember turning back this way. And the guy was getting closer and closer and closer. And he had on a big fur coat and a big fur hat. And it was very dark back here. There's not a lot of lighting out here. Saw these little flashing lights and... I was wondering why he was trying to take my picture or something. I thought, and then I realized it was a taser. It wasn't a camera.
What did you feel?
Electrocuted really badly. You know, it's like 50,000 volts with... I mean, it's a very effective weapon. So I fell here, and it was about 7 below, and there was ice everywhere. I knew what had happened, and he just grabbed the violin and got in the van and bolted off. By the time I got up, I saw the van going, zooming around the corner. And I was predictably hysterical. And I knew Todd was still here because his car was still there. And he ended up running over. And we were trying to call 911 and just get somebody out here.
They just had an armed robbery. The actor is a black male, 6 feet tall, thin build, fur hat. And the caller did state that he was tased.
There was a taser barb sticking out of my jacket and one stuck in my wrist right there. I was, like, bleeding on my shoes and had these strings hanging off me. And the whole thing was just, like, what? You know, I mean, those guys took your violin and shot you. It was none of, you know, we just couldn't believe it.
You must have thought your life was over as you kind of got to your feet.
Crazy. It was not a great feeling, I can tell you that.
I think I had actually just gone down for the evening and the phone rang. I was still awake.
Violin dealer Stefan Hirsch.
And Frank was on the phone, really in not a good state, telling me what had happened. I really couldn't even understand what he was talking about. The whole notion that he was tased and the violin was gone.
By this time, they had put me in the back of a squad car to kind of talk to me, and I was trying to call people to let them know what was happening.
I got a phone call from a friend of mine, Mike Gonzalez, who's on the symphony board.
Milwaukee Chief of Police Edward Flynn.
And I guess this is about 12:30 to about 10:30. Frank Almond, the, you know, lead violinist, concertmaster of the symphony, had been tased and robbed. Mike's beside himself, you know, can you call up and see how things are going? I said, hell yeah, call up the scene. And I get the sergeant. Sarge, Chief Flynn. Well, obviously, he's startled to hear from his chief at 12:30 in the morning. I said, what do you got? We got a guy here, somebody robbed him of his violin, you know, we're trying to get the story straight, it's a little confusing, but yeah, the guy's violin got stolen. I said, okay, listen to me carefully. All right, this isn't the violin. This is a multi-million dollar musical instrument. This is the crime of the century.
I
just shocked, worried for Frank because he was tased. I've known Frank since the early 80s. So, you know, the thought of this happening to your mild-mannered...
Call the cavalry. You know, we've got a Metropolitan Division. They're mainly homicides, the hardest stuff they get because they're our best detectives. Get crime scene people there. Get everybody there. You have to understand this is like not another robbery.
There was all this speculation. It was a, you know, an international job, and it's on its way to God knows where, and it'll hang on a wall and never be played. And we were just abuzz, everyone.
This was bad on a whole bunch of levels, and I knew that the symbolism of this event was damn near as important as the reality of the event. Because I could hear, you know, Milwaukee, oh, somebody stole it. They better get help, you know, or some such thing. And I knew we had the capabilities to get it done, particularly if we jumped on it soon enough and treated it seriously immediately. This was Milwaukee's piece of the Western cultural heritage, fallen prey to a vicious street crime, all right? This is something we needed to take seriously, rectify, put our best foot forward, and demonstrate a commitment to solving the crime and recovering the piece of art. And that was non-negotiable, and I didn't care what people said. And even some of my own coppers were like, well, what are we doing all this work? You know, I'd have to sit there and say, okay, would you feel this way if somebody had taken Jennifer Lawrence's emerald necklace worth $1 million? Would you feel like you were wasting your time on this, okay?
We had had persistent inquiries after the violin. Someone who knew we were connected to it in the trade had, there were these persistent inquiries from Eastern Europe, and, you know, we knew the violin wasn't for sale and had said the violin isn't for sale. So that was, it was kind of lingering in the back of my head, and I wound up in a sort of mini paranoid fantasy about that for a few days.
We had two working theories all along, and they were parallel. One was mastermind stealing a Stradivarius to get it out of the country to put in somebody's collection. But the part we were scratching our heads about was, okay, that makes sense for a painting. You can't look at a violin. I mean, you know, it's priceless if it's played. It's worthless if it's sitting somewhere gradually falling to pieces. It's what I call the knucklehead factor. Never underestimate the fact that your high-end thief is, in fact, essentially a dreaming bumbler.
While Frank Almond recovered from the attack, the forensic team at the scene of the crime had discovered little confetti-like pieces of paper that had been expelled when the taser gun was fired. It transpired that each of these was stamped with a serial number that led back to the original purchaser of the weapon.
We had to figure out the confetti. We had to get Taser to cooperate with us. We had to trace it to a warehouse and back it up to somebody who bought it. The same token, we had to have cops in the community that people trusted enough to tell them community gossip. We had that working for us at the same time, and the two pieces came together within a week to give us a suspect.
The taser was traced back to a Milwaukee barber called Universal Knowledge Allah. He had bought the taser on behalf of his friend Salah Salahuddin, the man who carried out the robbery.
First, I was told we made the arrest, because now we had to do the negotiation. That's where the DA's office came in. How do we get these guys to, all right, where is it? It's more important than what happens to you is what happens to the violin. Okay, so that required the DA doing thoughtful negotiations about the range of penalties they'd face if they said, okay, this is where it is.
The $6 million violin was found inside an old suitcase Salahuddin had given to an unsuspecting friend just to look after for a few days.
Frank was out of town after the violin was recovered, and the authorities were most anxious, first of all, to verify that they had the right one, to verify that it hadn't been damaged. So I drove up and was really happy and relieved to see that really nothing bad had happened to it. It was kind of amazing.
It was wrapped in a baby blanket, I believe.
You know, we don't keep a stash of baby blankets for wrapping violins at the shop. It's not really the way it's done.
I mean, in their heads, they were the protagonists of a really cool caper movie. But in reality, they were in a sitcom.
My name is Paul Chichinsky. I'm a trial attorney in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I was the attorney for Universal Allah. Take a look at Universal's background. No criminal record of any kind. You know, not you know, even the slightest thing. Strong family background, strong job, kinds of pro-social things. And all of a sudden you get this idea of, I'm going to commit a crime. You know, where does this come from?
He procured the taser that was used during the robbery. He wasn't actually one of the robbers.
Yes, to me that was critical, I thought, for Judge Maroney to recall, is that he did not actually participate in the robbery, wasn't there, didn't have the taser, but nevertheless, he did play a part. I mean, there's no getting around that. He did get the taser.
Sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah, okay.
Did he tell you why he bought a taser for a friend? It sounds like a really unwise thing to do for somebody who's running a successful business, no convictions.
I've given up trying to make sense of it. There is not sense to some of this. Could it have been misplaced loyalty? I mean, you know, the path to hell is paved with good intentions, right? You know, he's just thinking, well, I'm going to help a friend. I'm going to get him out of here. Should he have thought it through? Absolutely. Should he have known better? Absolutely. But he didn't. I never asked Universal directly, you know, exactly what the circumstances were.
Too good a lawyer to do that.
We have to remember, in Wisconsin, this is what's special about Wisconsin. Do you know, Wisconsin has the highest black incarceration rate in the nation? In the nation! Higher than anyone, any other state. Now, what does that mean? It means we have to be careful. There was a very famous Supreme Court justice, United States Supreme Court justice, very conservative, Justice Frankfurter, who said justice requires the appearance of justice. Pretty profound thought if you sit and go through it. And that's what I tried to emphasize to Judge Maroney is, and Judge Maroney, I've appeared before and I have great respect for it. I think he did a fine job. But my point, what I tried to emphasize to him is that we don't want even the appearance that there was not justice here. Because of these kind of statistics that we have from Wisconsin, we have to be careful.
That people don't see there's a predisposition to come down especially hard.
Well, look at what we have going on in the United States right now. We have Ferguson. We have, you know, things going on in L.A., in New York. So that's why the term that is used now in the criminal justice system itself is evidence-based. In other words, whatever you do, it has to have an based on evidence. Not what I feel, what I believe, but what's evidence-based. Why is a barber helping someone steal a priceless art object? This I did ask Universal. He had no comprehension of what this was.
Quite some distance from the classical music cognoscenti of Milwaukee is Yuli's Cigar and Tobacco Shop. I've come to speak to some of the customers about the Lipinski incident and to experience this legendary, heavily air-conditioned smoke room.
Unfortunate thing is that I think if you go to any greater metropolitan city, you're going to find that crime is there.
It's sad just to hear anybody, you know, who has to take someone else's stuff. I mean, but unfortunately, thievery is around wherever. I mean, you just hear about a lot of more things that happen in the inner city than you do outside of the major city. So I just wish it never would have happened.
Sure,
because we have enough things going on in the city of Milwaukee that we don't need any bad news. But we also have good things that people do not report about in Milwaukee.
My name is Quincy Harper. I work at Waste Management and everything. So, you know, I dig through garbage all day and everything. That's, but other than that, I go to the Art Institute. And I just kind of thought to myself, whoever was carrying that violin around just was really asking for it to get taken, like, really badly. So, I mean,
do you think then that actually it was a sort of a reality check for what the 21st century is like?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. Walking around with a $6 million violin isn't like your best, you know, carry-around tool and everything. So everybody was freaking out about the violin.
All the news about the Lipinski when all of this happened, I think what it did was sort of alert people, maybe reignite an interest. It sort of kicked at the complacency. Yeah, we have a symphony. Yeah, they play a very nice season. Yeah, Frank does a chamber music series, and isn't that nice? But suddenly people were hungry to see this and to hear it.
So there might have been an element of we didn't know what we'd got until we almost lost it.
Maybe? I think that's I think that's a good way to put it. Very much so. The first concert he did after the Lipinski was returned was at an art center in one of the western suburbs, the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center in Brookfield. And I tell you, people were packed cheek by jowl. There was press lined up along the back wall. I cover classical music and dance. I do not, as a rule, file quick dispatches. I heard the first piece, and then I had to leave the hall and write a quick dispatch and mail it off. Then at intermission, I had to file another quick dispatch and mail it off, email it. And then I had to go find a room in the theater and write the review and email that. Totally unusual in the way classical music is usually covered. But suddenly the whole city wanted to know. They wanted to know, you know, how does Frank look? You know, how does the instrument sound? Is it any different? It was amazing.
We'd come through for the community. We had preserved the honor of our city and our symphony, so to speak. Those grizzled detectives, you should have seen them on the stage of the MSO when they had the concert the next Saturday, and Frank Allman was going to play, and we got to introduce everybody that was involved in the investigation on the stage at MSO to a packed house. And all of a sudden, it wasn't all about elite snobs who get to enjoy this music. It's like, we did a good thing. So much of police work necessarily is about human misery, okay? Seeing the worst of people, people at their worst. We see the victims right after they've been victimized. We're in the home environment wherever the misery is taking place. This can be such a spirit-crushing job. So to involve yourself in something like this, something that was fundamentally about rescuing something of beauty, and that made everybody feel good in the end. And, everybody needs that.
I think it was 2 weeks ago, I was getting into my seat at a symphony concert, and, you know, the concertmaster is the last to walk out on the stage and signal for the tuning note, so that chair was empty, and a woman in the row behind me was explaining to her companion, now that's the chair that Frank Almond will sit in, and he plays that Stradivarius that was stolen. I thought, here we are. People are still buzzing about. It's very interesting.
Now, I suppose can have an upside and a downside in that, you know, it's the curious who would slow down for a car crash or maybe just have a look at the survivors of the car crash. Do you think that people have been persuaded into enjoying a world that they'd no experience of before as a result of this?
I think so. I think not in football stadium throngs,
sure.
Certainly, but I'm quite certain there's an element of that. And I think in one of the ways in which you can see it is Frank's Frankly Music series. He's been doing this series for years. It's a very shirt sleeves rapport that he's built up with the audience. He does spoken program notes and very casually and, you know, the occasional joke, a one-liner here and there. It's very, very relaxed, very companionable. And it's done well. It is doing better. They have moved to a larger hall. People have been buying tickets in greater numbers. I think there is an element of sort of people who were maybe peripherally aware now appreciating in a new way. And I think there's a little bit of pride in the fact that that instrument is here, and this was a terrible thing that happened.
History is littered with occasions when out of terrible trauma comes great art. I asked Elaine Schmidt if she felt that Frank's performance had been affected by the attack and robbery.
I just heard him play the Schindler's List solo under John Williams a couple of weeks ago. And, I mean, that solo, if you've seen the film, and oh my gosh. But there is, because of the size of the sound of the instrument, there's a sense of intimacy no matter where you are in the hall. You can be in, you know, the top of the cheap seats. Mm. And that sound is so present and so full.
And up close almost?
Oh, yes. It gives you a sense of intimacy with the player that is really kind of incredible. And in a small hall, it's almost addictive. You know, you lean in, you want to hear a little more because the sound really just sort of wraps around you.
Mm.
And isn't that one of the mysteries of those old Strats?
Okay. So here it is.
Oh my goodness.
It's very humbling to play an instrument like this when you know that there are documented concerts with Lipinski playing Beethoven sonatas with Franz Liszt at the piano, you know?
Does it throw up pictures in your imagination, or is it just the music?
That's a tough question. I think I would drive myself crazy if every time I played the Devil's Trill Sonata, I thought about Tartini playing that piece on this violin. I mean, he could just go nuts. The biggest emotion I would feel is a sense of humility. You know, there's a lot of mixed emotion about it because this guy planned it for what appeared to be several years. This person had apparently become obsessed with stealing one. He was just going to do it and spent years and knew where I lived and he knew my car and he knew some of my routines and he knew the names of my kids. And when somebody tells you that, then you look at everything a little bit differently.
In November 2014, Salah Salahuddin Jones was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment for the attack on Frank Almond and the theft of the Lipinski. Universal Allah is serving 3.5 years for supplying the taser stun gun used in the attack. 2015 marks 300 years since the Lipinski violin left the workshop of Antonio Stradivari. I'm Peter Curran, and this was a Foghorn Company production for the BBC World Service.
Peter Curran is the producer of The Lipinski. It's a BBC World Service radio documentary. It's available on the BBC World Service website for the next month, and there is a link to it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that wraps up our January 1st edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North, wishing you and yours a very happy new year. Thanks so much for tuning in. Lake Effect returns tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.